This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Welcome to Part 7 of Macro Voices Eurodollar University with Alhambra Investments CIO, Jeffrey Snyder. I'm your host, Eric Townsend. There's a slide deck to accompany this podcast, and we recommend that you download it before listening, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs it contains throughout this program. You'll find the download link, along with other parts of this series, at macrovoices.com/edu for Eurodollar University. At the end of the last episode, Jeff had explained in detail how the system had broken down to the point where collapse was accelerating and starting to get out of control. Now let's jump back in right where we left off as Jeff starts to explain the Fed's efforts to intervene. We're on slide 93 in the PowerPoint deck. Okay, Jeff, given that description of the problem, moving on to slide 93, where and how does the Fed try to intervene, and how successful are they?
You know, I think that really registers, going back to the beginning of the presentation here, you know, the difference between the traditional understanding of monetary policy and what it can do versus what the system actually was and what monetary policy really couldn't do. So put yourself in Ben Bernanke's shoes here. Not that I'm trying to paint him in any kind of sympathetic light, but if you're Ben Bernanke and you believe the system operates like it did in 1955, where do you intervene? What exactly do you do here? How do you stop this pro-cyclical hoarding of balance sheet capacity? And where you shouldn't have sympathy for Ben Bernanke is that he should have known better. I mean, it was his job, right? The idea of the Federal Reserve is that they are the monetary banking steward, and so therefore – they should have had all of the stuff mapped out beforehand. They should have known all about the Eurodollar system, its potential for fragmentation, and all of the faults and all the ways in which it broke down. Again, going back to where Bernanke was in early 2007, the reason he said subprime was contained was because this stuff was hidden for him. But as it became revealed as a big problem and a global problem, because he didn't really understand the system as it was, and they still don't today, where do you intervene? And so if you go to slide 94, they only tried to intervene in one particular spot, which was the liability side, which was what we think of as traditional liquidity, and just the Bank B portion. That's where they did the TF auctions. That's where we had the effect of lowering the federal funds rate. That's where they had their collateralized discount window types of alternate programs. That's where the dollar swaps all went. They never intervene in any of this other stuff like credit default swaps, derivatives, balance sheet capacity, simply because they didn't realize that that was where they needed to intervene. And not only that, their interventions on that particular part, that one specific piece, the liability side of Bank A, they were always behind. They were never able to actually respond effectively. So not only did they leave the asset side, the more important side of all of this dark leverage and all of these derivatives out of their monetary policy response to the crisis, even where they did intervene on the liability side, it was half measures that were poorly thought out and ineffective anyway. Putting it all together, there was probably zero chance that the Federal Reserve could have done anything in 2007 and 2008 that would have been effective. I've often said that the only thing they could have done possibly that would have maybe had a chance of forestalling crisis, at least of the magnitude that it became, was if they had actually taken over AIG and all of the other insurers and completely taken over writing credit default swaps on behalf of all of those insurance companies, not just taking their assets onto their books and effectively quarantining, but actually doing all of the functions of the credit defaults and the interest rate swap market, so that banks could go back to the way, or at least try to go back to the way of efficiently managing their balance sheets without having them reverse on them. And even then, I don't think it would have been enough. I don't think the Federal Reserve ever had any chance, even if it had done some of really exotic balance sheet type activities. I don't think it would have been enough because the way things progressed and the way that the banks were recoiling and hoarding their capacity was probably beyond the control or the ability to control of anybody.
Okay, Jeff. So the point that we're really making here is this is not about credit risk. This is about systemic contagion and liquidity and things breaking down all across the system. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what we're really talking about here. We're talking about the monetary system. We're not talking about subprime mortgages and the ability of less than qualified borrowers to pay back on Alt-A or Ninja loans. That was just one of the first indications of stress. But what we're really talking about here is liquidity structures, money structures that spread not just inside the United States and into these various weird and exotic places, but all across the world. Remember, when we talk about on August 9, 2007, it was a European money market fund operating in U.S. dollar asset-backed security commercial paper. This was a global monetary issue. And the issue was largely that there was tremendous liquidity risk embedded in all of these systems that was misdiagnosed as the opposite, because everything was perceived to be safe. But the way that which these all of these structures were built was done so in a way that there was very little risk at all, not just credit risk, but you know, more importantly, that nobody appreciated the liquidity risk, because it was assumed that all these markets would be together forever, that they would operate seamlessly as a flexible dynamic whole, when in fact there was a massive risk that these could all fall apart. And when it all fell apart, there would be no way to put it back together again. So the issue wasn't subprime. It was always Eurodollar.
Well, Jeff, since this is Eurodollar University, let's talk about Eurodollars and the role that they played in terms of predicting and acting as an indicator as to what was coming and perhaps what was still to come.
Yeah, if we look at something like the Eurodollar futures market, which are derivative contracts that are settled in LIBOR. So they're a money market rate, they're cash settled, which means they don't actually settle in actual Eurodollar deposit. But because they relate to LIBOR and the money market rate that's tied to all the stuff that we've been talking about, Eurodollar futures were a pretty good indication of not just how things were progressing, but more so what that would mean over the long run. Because that's what we're really interested in here. You know, sitting here 10 years later, still talking about the crisis in 2008, obviously there are issues that have never been resolved, and we want to understand what those issues were. And I think the Eurodollar futures market was a good indication in real time that not only that things were falling apart, but that as they fell apart, they were going to fall apart in a permanent way. So if we look on slide 96, for example, what I've highlighted in dark blue is the Eurodollar futures contract that expired in June 2007, just before all of this stuff started to happen. And what I hope you can notice from this slide is that starting even in late 2006, some of the other Eurodollar futures contracts fell below in price that June 2007 maturity. And what that was saying to Ben Bernanke and Bill Dudley and all those guys in the FOMC was that, hey, the market's getting a little nervous about all this stuff. Now, the FOMC and policymakers were starting to write off the housing bust as nothing more than a small thing that, you know, okay, would cause some heartache and some mild anxiety, but it wasn't a big deal. When the Eurodollar futures market was essentially saying that, okay, you've raised the federal funds rate up to 5.25% through 2006, so we're going to believe here that it's before the next couple of years, you're going to actually have to lower it. That's what the futures market inversion at that point was saying, is that, you know, we expect LIBOR rates to be lower, not higher. And that was contrary to what the Federal Reserve was thinking at the time. Again, Bernanke saying subprime was contained. What the Eurodollar futures market was telling us at the time was that, okay, maybe this thing isn't contained. Maybe it's a lot bigger than what we think it is. And this market is particularly important and particularly prime, in a prime position to understand the dynamic nature here because of where the Eurodollar futures sit in terms of balance sheet capacity and managing everything. Eurodollar futures are intimately tied into things like interest rate swaps. So that market, as it became more problematic, was hedged and was used as a proxy for Eurodollar futures too. So the Eurodollar futures market, as it went through after August 2007, kept showing and kept indicating that, of course, the Federal Reserve was behind the curve and that interest rates were looked to be going lower and lower and lower into the future. And so, you know, if we go to slide 97, you see the 2008 contract, which was ahead of the curve, ahead of the federal funds curve, that is, the federal funds target going down in that period of time. Not only that, after Bear Stearns had failed, if we go to slide 98, it showed us that the Eurodollar futures market was reacting to that LIBOR spread as well. So the market was indicating not just that there were problems, but also where those problems were. And then if we go to slide 99, what that meant, because the further out maturities, the longer maturities like in June 2010 and June 2011, were starting to price in a much lower future interest rate environment in terms of money rates, in terms of LIBOR, which meant that, okay, the Fed was going to, number one, have to reduce the federal funds rate all the way down to zero. Number two, they were going to have to keep it there for a very long length of time. And the market was expecting this at a time when people didn't think this was all very much of a big deal. Even after Bear Stearns had failed, there was still a consensus that this wasn't even going to be a recession in the U.S., that there wasn't going to be anything more than this one failure of this one investment bank on Wall Street. Where the market here is saying, no, this is going to be not only a much bigger deal, it's going to be a much bigger deal that lasts a very, very long time. That's where we get to on slide 100, when you start seeing some of these longer dated contracts like June 2010. Not only through the crisis, you have the LIBOR spread, but then afterward, where you see that the prices of these Eurodollar futures contracts approach 100, which is closer and closer to zero rate further out into the future.
Okay, Jeff, this seems unprecedented for Eurodollar futures to be approaching 100, which basically means that people are lending at zero. What are the implications of that? What is it telling us?
Well, what we should normally see, if that period in 2007, 2008 had been just a normal business cycle that was just, you know, a severe recession, for example, what you would expect, especially the June 2011 and further out contracts, you'd expect them to go back up to their normal prices they were beforehand. Because that would tell us that, okay, the market expects that LIBOR will be at a rate consistent to where it was before August 2007. But because the contracts instead went closer and closer to 100, what the market was saying was that, okay, this is not just a temporary recession type event. It's turned out to be a permanent break, but at the time it was like, okay, this is a much bigger thing than just a temporary setback, a severe setback nonetheless, because, you know, what happened in with not just Bear Stearns, but Lehman Brothers, AIG, and the rest. But everybody expected that this was still going to be a business cycle, that we'd get into recovery, the money system would eventually heal, and Eurodollar futures are saying, no, this is much more than that. We're into something that is very different here, where what happened in 2007 and 2008 through to 2009 was a permanent rupture in the system. Therefore, we don't expect that the Federal Reserve is going to get off of its zero interest rate policy anytime in the foreseeable future. That's a big deal in terms of understanding that this was not a one-time thing. This was not a one-off problem. The markets were saying, and of course, again, Eurodollar futures being where it is in the situated in the system had a good seat to what's going on in the shadow world, that this is a permanent rupture. This is not a temporary break.
Okay, Jeff, so what we're saying here is, once again, Eurodollar futures are really that leading indicator that's telling us a very important message back at that point in time, which is, hey, everybody thinks that this is a cyclical problem, that we're just going through a business cycle, and we're getting a very clear message from Eurodollar futures saying, no, actually, something is systemically broken, and it's going to stay broken. Now, moving on from there, I see on slide 101, we're moving into, speaking of things really being broken, that blow up in LIBOR. So what's the Fed thinking at this point? Have they figured out that something is systemically broken and going to stay broken, or are they still stuck in cyclical thinking?
Yeah, you would think that by, especially after Lehman Brothers and all the stuff that went on in September 2008, they would have realized that they had a lot more on their hands than just what they had thought. And this was no longer just a subprime issue or even a credit issue, but a full monetary and liquidity issue. But they didn't. One of the ways that we can analyze and one of the ways we can display that lack of progression and evolution in their thinking is something called IOER, which is the interest paid on excess reserves. Now, they had authorized the payment of interest on excess reserve for the banking system way back a couple years before. That wasn't supposed to begin until 2010. With what happened in October 2008 with full-blown panic, stock market crashing and everything else, they moved up that authority because they wanted to address this issue where the federal funds effective rate kept being below the target rate, which is a problem. Because remember, the way monetary policy works is you want the effective rate to be close to the target rate on either side, not too high or not too low. And so they instituted IOER to act as a floor, because what it would do would be allow banks to deposit funds essentially at the Federal Reserve, these reserve balances that were being created by all of the various liquidity operations that the Fed was undertaking. They would then be paid at this rate, which was initially set at 35 basis points below target. And it was believed that that would be an effective way to put a floor underneath the federal funds effective rate, because why would you lend at less than IOER when you could get IOER from the Federal Reserve? If IOER was set at 1.5%, why would you lend in federal funds at 1%? What ends up happening, as you can see on slide 101, is that IOER never worked as a floor. In fact, it got to be such a big problem that by early November 2008, they even erased the spread. In other words, they raised the IOER rate so that it was equivalent to the federal funds target. They raised it so that if IOER was going to be effective at providing a floor at 35 basis points less, it should be more effective at a rate consistent with federal funds target. But as you can see, it was actually less effective. And so the Federal Reserve, as we progress to slide 102, even though they changed their tactical approach to this one particular problem, they never really got outside of that thinking. They kept approaching the system from the perspective of bank reserves and these limited reserves that they were creating for monetary policy and how that related to the federal funds rate. They never really understood the wider stuff, the wider shadow market stuff that we've been talking about. And it showed because of the way IOER never really worked as intended. And to this day, it still doesn't work as intended. It never became a floor for money market rates because the Fed doesn't really know what's going on in all of these money markets. As I wrote on slide 103, IOER has never worked as a floor. And even today, it's not used as a floor. But that's the way it was instituted. And that's the way they used it during the crisis. And yet they had no idea why it wasn't. Why wasn't this working? And they never did really figure that out.
Jeff, for the last few minutes, we've been focusing on a lot of Fed policy issues, things that happened in the United States specifically. Let's tie this into the bigger picture of what was going on globally and how these events affected the global financial system.
If you're looking at slide 103, the big thing that sticks out is the orange line, which is three-month LIBOR. And that's, again, we remind ourselves that this is a global problem. This is not just the United States problem. And one of the ways, that's the reason IOER never really worked, was because the Fed conceived of their mandate from a geographical standpoint. They believe that their mandate ended at the borders of the United States, when in fact, what we're really talking about is a global dollar currency, a euro dollar currency, that involved banks all across the world. And the only way that they ever anticipated or they ever really tried to address that fact was in these dollar swaps that at the time, you go back to IOER, IOER was instituted in large part because of the reserves created via dollar swaps. So as the Fed is going heavily into further into these dollar swaps of foreign central banks, it wasn't working because not only was IOER unable to restrain the shallowness and the effective federal funds rate, those dollar swaps were doing nothing to LIBOR. They were not bringing the LIBOR spread back down to earth, which indicated that we're not having a whole lot of success offshore either. One of the reasons for it, if you go to slide 104, is everything we've been talking about. Banks in Switzerland have always traditionally been a huge part of the Eurodollar system. They take in dollar deposits in the early days. They take in dollar deposits and then redistribute them throughout the rest of the system, largely having nothing to do with the U.S. at all. Dollars that circulate outside the U.S., and they're not really dollars, but they're really just bank liabilities. But as you can see on the chart on slide 104, in the middle 2000s, especially, Swiss banks became aggressive in their euro-dollar redistribution, so to speak. And so before the middle of 2007, all the crisis erupted at that time, the Swiss banks were a major point of redistribution and a major source of dollar funding all across the rest of the world. And what's really evident here is exactly what we've seen in all of the rest of these various pieces, like the credit default swaps and everything else. Up until 2007, you have tremendous growth in these dollar activities in this one offshore conduit. But afterward, it didn't matter what the Fed did because the Swiss banks perceived the system in the way we've described it, which is before it was all return and no risk, and afterwards it's all risk and no return. Therefore, under that asymmetric situation, you don't want to participate in it. It doesn't matter what the Federal Reserve's doing. It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing anyplace else. What you do is you get out of that position. You've gotten yourself into something that's only risk, that only causes pain and only causes losses. And so you get out. So from especially 2008 forward, the Swiss banks, which were, again, a huge part of redistribution and creation of these euro dollar assets and liabilities, actually decided they didn't want to do it anymore.
Okay, Jeff. So if the Swiss don't want the business, what does that mean for the rest of the world?
Yeah, nothing good, Eric. And again, hindsight makes it pretty apparent what exactly happened. But, you know, if we look at it from the perspective of, again, a global currency system, we can use something like the Chinese currency and the dollar exchange rate with CNY. Up until July of 2008, it seemed as if you remember at that time, people started using the word decouple. The idea was that, okay, there's a problem in the U.S. economy, there's a problem in the European economy, but the emerging markets are going to be fine. They're going to grow, and that's a pretty good bet that even though that there's problems in the developed world, the emerging market economies would suffer no fallout from it. And up until about July 2008, that seemed to be the case, even in some of their financial and market indications like CNY and oil prices, for example. Following that, however, there was this contagion running through GSE paper. So at the same time Ben Bernanke was speaking in front of Congress, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission issued an emergency order banning the practice of naked short selling on not just the GSEs Fannie and Freddie, but also primary dealer bank stocks. And the reason they did so was in large part that the foreign pieces of the Eurodollar system were starting to develop not just economic uncertainty, but they were starting to participate in more directly these Eurodollar problems as they developed in terms of balance sheet capacity hoarding, what we saw from the Swiss banks in a couple slides earlier. And the response was pretty dramatic. Oil prices from July 15th forward crashed, and at the same time, the Chinese currency went into what would really look like a repeg situation where the PBOC was pegging the currency rate at a consistent level. What that really tells us is that the Eurodollar problems that were erupting in the United States and Europe were not just being limited to the United States and Europe, that there was never going to be any kind of decoupling, economically speaking or otherwise. The fact that the Chinese had to peg their currency meant that they were experiencing a massive dollar problem that was originating because of all of the stuff that was going on and these balance sheet capacity issues. And obviously, that's what the collapse in oil prices told us as well, was that the problems in the Eurodollar system, which may have started in things like U.S. local subprime issues, had progressed to become a worldwide dollar issue, a worldwide dollar run, if you will.
Okay, Jeff, so you're saying this is a broader issue. Can we put some statistics behind that?
Yeah, on slide 109, we get into some of the tick banking data, which again describes some of the activities that are reported to the Treasury Department as part of its Treasury International Capital Report. What this part of the report aggregates is U.S. banks' liabilities to foreigners payable in dollars. And when we're talking about liabilities to foreigners payable in dollars, what I've got pointed out here in the red portion is short-term treasury securities and other short-term securities, which are basically largely MBS securities that are used in the repo market. And what you see is that, you know, around September 2008, this transmission of MBS difficulties into a foreign place, into the place where Eurodollar funding in the repo market becomes completely frozen, largely because on slide 110, this repudiation of MBS and agency paper that was used in the repo market, which collapsed the collateral pool. And as it collapsed the collateral pool, it didn't do that just in the United States, but it did it globally. That's what we're looking at here. We're looking at a cross-border relationship between the U.S. banking system and the rest of the world. And starting in 2008 and then progressing further into the crisis, it was a global repo problem in terms of collateral, which of course led to further problems in all of the balance sheet capacities that we described before.
Okay, Jeff, and what's happening to the U.S. dollar at this point in the story?
Yeah, and that's another angle to all this, of course, is the exchange rate of the dollar and what that tells us as far as what's going on in these funding mechanisms globally. If you look on slide 111, what we're getting into is something like the dollar index, like DXY. I think most people remember that during this period, especially the housing bubble and the housing mania period, we had something that people classified and characterized as a falling dollar. And what that was actually consistent with was the increase in funding and increase in capacity in the Eurodollar system throughout there. So if we kind of think of the dollar's exchange value in terms of simple supply and demand fundamentals. There was an increase in supply, in fact, a massive increase in supply of balance sheet capacity and therefore, quote unquote, dollars in the global system. And as you expect from a massive increase in supply, the value of the dollar falls. Now, it had kept falling as we go to slide 112, even past the initial eruption and crisis in August 2007, all the way until Bear Stearns in early 2008. The dollar's exchange value continued to fall even though there was massive irregularity and imbalances building up inside the system. So it's not a one-to-one direct relationship between the supply and capacity of euro dollars globally and how that breaks out into the dollar's exchange value. However, as we can see with Bear Stearns on slide 112, that was the absolute low point in the dollar, because at that point, these problems became so large, became so globally interconnected, that it actually did end up affecting the dollar. And so we had what was a falling dollar before ended up becoming a rising dollar thereafter, as we look at on slide 113.
And of course, Jeff, on slide 113, we see the historic bottom at the end of 2008, beginning of 2009. What was the cause of that? Was it the announcement of QE1 or something else that caused this big reversal in the dollar?
Yeah, I've never been a proponent of the QE explanation for obvious reasons. Not just the fact that the Fed was stuck in the 1950s kind of mindset, but more so there were other more immediate and apparent and to me more logical explanations for why things ended, or at least temporarily ended the run at that particular point in time. If we go back and think about, you know, one of the biggest obvious problems of the crisis period, these OTTI impairments. Remember, another word for OTTI is mark to market. And if you recall, in early 2009, the banking system, a lot of banking officials began to complain to Congress and other entities, including the Federal Reserve and the Securities Exchange Commission, about OTTI and mark to market. And a lot of people dismissed it as nothing more than, you know, okay, the banks just want to be bailed out. They wanted to be able to mark to myth, I think is one of the charges people made about it. But the reason was that there was a lot of truth to what they were saying. These OTTI impairments didn't actually reflect credit risk. They were reflecting liquidity risk and liquidity conditions. And they were reflecting liquidity conditions in all of these various places that people didn't understand. And so as they were being accused of doing something shady and trying to reduce the effect of mark-to-market on their income statements, there was a lot of truth to that. And that's the reason why, starting in February 2009, the FESB and all sorts of officials, not just in the U.S., but globally, began to look at these OTTI impairments and said, you know what, there's something to this here. We've classified them as mark-to-market impairments, but in truth, some of these prices are not actually legitimately economic prices. And so by early March 2009, it became clear that authorities, particularly the FESB and the Securities Exchange Commission, we're going to act favorably upon the banking system's proposal. They at least alter or at least give banks the option of getting out from under this mark-to-market OTTI impairment problem, which actually happened in the middle of March 2009. The FASB proposed 157E, 115A, all of the various OTTI proposals. And the effect of that was it removed a lot of these OTTI losses and prospective losses from bank balance sheets. And when you do that, the banking system doesn't look so bad. It starts to look like, okay, this is just a liquidity problem. This is just a liquidity run, and not Citigroup isn't actually insolvent. Citigroup was just unwise in the way it funded its balance sheet. Now, the two things are very different circumstances, and they have very different implications. And so I believe that it wasn't actually the Fed and QE that ended the run and the panic in 2009. It was the removal of the threat of OTTI impairments, because if you're Citigroup and you no longer have to worry about mark to market, then you're not going to pressure the default swap market. You're not going to pressure the interest rate swap market. You're not going to need to do all of those things that kept spreading contagion into all of these shadow places any longer, because you don't have to worry about the fact that you're going to have to book a loss that isn't really a loss anymore.
Well, Jeff, looking at slide 14 here, as you say, that ended the panic in the end of 2008, beginning of 2009. But we see another cyclical top here in March 5 of 2009, not too much further. So clearly, we haven't solved the problem completely. What's going on the right half of slide 114 here?
Eric, our main concern here is that, okay, that may have caused the end of the run in that particular point in time, but it didn't solve any of the problems. It just alleviated the massive pressures that had built up to that particular point in time. But it left in place all of these structural issues that we've been talking about all along, because the dollar has only been rising, not in a straight line, obviously. The dollar's value has increased. And as we mentioned, you know, things like euro dollar futures, there's every indication that what happened in 2007, 2008, and 2009 was not a temporary deviation from trend. A solid trend, it was a break in that trend. And that's, I think, what the exchange value of the dollar is telling us, is that the balance sheet capacity, the euro-dollar system as it was beforehand, was broken completely on August 9th, 2007, and it has never gone back to something like a more healthy function.
Okay, Jeff, this has been pretty involved, so let's review the major points. I see you've got a summary slide starting on page 115.
Yeah, the first thing, again, we want to emphasize this was never credit risk as much as it was liquidity and therefore money system risk. The monetary framework was thought to be a seamless whole that operated in such a fashion that it was completely safe. You could grow your balance sheet as far and as fast as you wanted to. You never really had to worry about any of these things because you thought there were all sorts of redundancies built into the system. You know, whether it be liquidity backstops for your SIVs, whether it be asset-backed commercial paper versus repo, collateralized, everything, all that stuff. And at the back of all of that stuff, if anything broke down in serious fashion, everybody believed in the Greenspan put, right? Because that was the myth that had survived from the 90s and even into the 2000s, was that if everything got really, really bad, which was, you know, impossible to begin with, but if it ever did happen, the Federal Reserve would bail everybody out. We could count on the Fed to actually completely and successfully absorb any major systemic problems that developed. And that was proven to be, by the events in 2007 and 2008, not true. Not only were those liquidity structures frail, they actually ended up being pro-cyclical. Rather than act as a firewall to make sure that liquidity problems didn't spread, they actually spread the problems themselves. They actually acted as points of contagion, as we went through before, between Bank A, Bank B, Bank C, and Bank D. And so everything we thought about in terms of how safe and how robust the system was, this monetary system was, before 2007, was proven without a doubt to be actually weak and actually very fragile.
Jeff, I think these comments you've just made pretty much cover slide 116 and 117. Moving on to slide 118, you're making a point about exponential growth here. What's going on?
Well, that's, I think, what really kept everything together, what actually made it seem like this was a intrinsically solid system before everything developed in 2007, was that so long as everything was growing exponentially, like a spinning top, it seemed to be very stable. And so people accepted it that way, and people participating in it were unable to actually see all of the problems that had developed, all of the problems that were inherent in it all along the way. And one of the reasons for it is because, as we hopefully people can appreciate, that the way the balance sheets were constructed, the way this thing all actually worked, was that it was a self-funding thing. It wasn't like we needed an outside source of money to come into the system in order for it to grow. It created those types of funding mechanisms. It created those types of balance sheet capacity transactions that allowed the growth itself to fund itself. And so it looked like a system that was robust, but it was all an illusion. And once it started to slow down and once it started to fall in on itself, there was no way to stop it because nobody had really any idea what was going on. So if we go to slide 119, the slightest deviation, again, the subprime problem was not a big deal. It was a very small part of the system. And really, if the liquidity system, the money system globally had been at all healthy, had been at all actually robust, the subprime thing never would have been a big deal. And so, again, I don't want to paint Bernanke sympathetically, but you can understand or at least appreciate where he was coming from when he said subprime was contained, because he believed that the liquidity system, the money system that he understood, would have easily absorbed such a small problem. What he didn't understand, of course, was that there was this, all this other stuff out there, all of this shadow Eurodollar stuff globally that made it all look that way. And so the issue is asymmetry. Before August 2007, it was believed that you could grow exponentially into any kind of the riskiest stuff, and the system had all of these ways and manners to make even the most risky crap and turn it into something that looks safe. So you have an environment where everybody perceived it to be all return with no risk. And so afterwards, it's been completely reoriented, where we go to slide 120 now, where it's now all risk and no return. And the reason we know it's all risk, because it's been proven to be all risk. Everything that happened in 2007 and 2008, and even afterward, we can get into the QEs at some other time, but everything that has happened in the last 11 years, nearly 11 years, has proven that these liquidity problems, as we saw back with the dollar exchange value, have never been solved. All of these problems, all of these intrinsic issues that are embedded still in the Eurodollar system are still there. These money markets are still fragmented. And so the entire paradigm has been upended and it's turned upside down or inside out, however you want to classify it, because what used to be riskless return is now returnless risk. And that's an absolutely complete paradigm shift.
Indeed. I remember, I think it was around that time that Bill Gross first coined that phrase of return-free risk. Moving on to slide 121, where are we headed from here?
Well, if you're a bank that operated in this environment pre-crisis and then afterward, it can't have been anything other than a complete reassessment of your participation in it, right? I mean, you can't put the horses back in the barn. You can't go backwards in this kind of a situation because everything that you believed in the system beforehand has been proven to be wrong. It's proven to be false. And so as a bank that participated, and Bear Stearns was an important part of this because it proved not only was this a big deal more than subprime, but it showed everybody what the ultimate risk was. And the ultimate risk was that, yeah, you could fail as a bank in this modern 21st century age. You could be taken out and liquidated. And of course, it wasn't just Bear Stearns, but Bear Stearns was kind of like the wake-up call. And I think that's why you see, especially on something like the dollar index, and it wasn't just the dollar index, but you know, some of the tick data too. Bear Stearns is kind of like the clean break where growth in the system beforehand, suddenly everybody realized, okay, there are some really serious downsides to participation in it. And once you get to that point, as I've highlighted on slide 121 and 122, you don't want to do it anymore. Why would you? Because first of all, there's no return in it. And secondly, it's all risk. And so that kind of asymmetry has provided us with a glimpse into why this thing has become such a structural break, why it was a permanent alteration in the system and not just a temporary deviation in trend. From slides 123 forward, what I provided here with are individual cases of the assets and the balance sheets of individual banks that used to be big participants in the system. You know, where did that balance sheet capacity come from? It came from individual banks that operated across the globe. So on 123, you got Citigroup. And you go back to their annual report in 2007, they made it sound like this is a completely safe bank because they have almost $900 billion, more than $800 billion in deposit funding, yet they had more than $2 trillion in assets. What that tells us is what happened later in 2008, why Citigroup got bailed out was because there was all of this other stuff embedded within it that they thought was no problem before 2008. And then afterwards, as you can see on their history of the total assets and on the balance sheet, they're no longer willing to grow. I mean, what does that say when Citigroup doesn't even want to grow anymore? Essentially, it's a smaller bank today than it was 10 years ago. And just in linear terms, in nonlinear terms, it's a massive reduction in capacity because they don't want to participate in a system where everything is asymmetric against them. And of course, Citigroup is not alone.
Okay, Jeff, it looks to me like in the next several slides, if we use Citigroup as a template, we're basically, you're just showing evidence here of the same thing proves true in the case of several more banks. You've got several slides providing that evidence. Let's move on to slide 132, where you start to get into the systemic implications of all this.
Yeah, and I think we start from the perspective that from a general overview, this is nothing new. I mean, a bank run is a bank run. We've seen these kinds of things before. Yes, it happened in terms of balance sheet capacity. It happened in a lot of these exotic formats like derivatives and credit default swaps and things like that that make it harder to understand, especially for lay people operating outside of it. But, you know, because it's nothing new, we should at least be able to understand the implications of it. But in this case, moving on to slide 133, unlike past episodes of bank runs, what we found is, again, all of those slides before about how the banks have changed their behavior, is that, you know, the curious thing about it is nothing happened afterwards. Throughout history, whenever we've experienced a bank run, there's at least some kind of attempt to address the deficiencies that led to bank run. You think back to the 1930s, for example, there was all sorts of efforts that were aimed at official efforts and even industry efforts within the banking system, the common goal to make sure that it never happened again. And I don't know if this is the first time in history, but it certainly seems like it's from my review of history that after what happened, it was like there's no attempt to really understand what happened. It just had happened and everybody kind of went, okay, it happened. Now what do we do? The same system has been left in place And it's the first time where we have continued central bank intervention that doesn't do anything, doesn't solve the problem. And nobody seems either able or willing to recognize what exactly that means and why things haven't changed despite so much time since this all happened.
Jeff, moving on to slide 134, if we've got these dollar problems, how does that translate to broader problems in the general economy globally?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, largely the point here in terms of consequences of a permanent paradigm shift, if you will. If you have a money supply issue, however you want to define money, and I understand it's almost impossible to define money in this Eurodollar setup, but however you want to define money, if you have a monetary problem that persists, it can only act as a drag or an anchor on economic growth. And we're not talking about just United States economic growth or European economic growth. We're talking about global economic growth because this is a global monetary problem because it's a global currency. And so sustained economic growth is impossible in this type of environment because money and economy are inseparable. You can't separate the two. In a modern economy that is anything that's other than a barter economy, the money supply issue is a important one. And in a lot of cases like this, where there's only monetary dysfunction and chronic dysfunction, it's only going to have a negative effect on economy. And people often say, you know, we realize the economy never recovered. We never experienced a recovery in the United States. There was no recovery in Europe. There's no recoveries now in a lot of different places around the world too. And nobody seems able to understand or appreciate or even figure out why that is. And one of the reasons is because people like Ben Bernanke, people like the Federal Reserve, people who work at the Federal Reserve, they're still taking at their word about what happened in 2008. It's still a subprime issue. It wasn't ever a money issue. And that's just wrong. And it's demonstrably false. And the implications of it are, as we go forward in our presentation from 135 into 136, we're not just talking about economic growth anymore. We're not just talking about a lack of recovery. We're starting to see symptoms. And I know this is something you've talked about before, Eric. We're starting to see symptoms of social and political instability and disruption.
Well, Jeff, as you know, that is my biggest concern, is I think that a lot of the things that we're seeing, whether it's the Eurodollar system or elsewhere in financial markets, they're painting a picture to me that spells a very grim future in terms of social stability and wealth inequality and the problems that I think society is going to face moving forward. But let's not go down that rat hole because, as you know, I can go on forever on that one. I see as we move on to slide 136, Italy comes into the picture here. How does Italy fit into the story?
Well, I think Italy is an interesting case study in what we're talking about, the implications of a monetary drag and a persistent monetary drag that's lasted for as long as it has. The mainstream case is that, okay, Italy's economy is fine. If you look at it from 2013 forward, by and large, you see that it's growing again. In March of 2018, they held a national election that went heavily, probably more heavily than most people anticipated, against the status quo, against the EU, against the common currency. And there's this struggle in the mainstream as if this is some kind of mystery because the economy can't be the problem. It's growing again. It's even accelerated in 2016 and 2017. So why are Italians so angry about something? And it usually devolves into, you know, political name calling and things like that. But if you look at, you know, slide 137, again, Italy's economy appears to be growing. But if you go to slide 138, you start to understand, why is there so much anger in Italy? Well, since 2008, Italy's economy has shrunk. Not only has it shrunk, after 10 years, it stayed shrunk. And so on, you know, 139, what I've labeled here is that, you know, maybe there's something to all this voter revolt in that people on the ground in Italy sense that there is something very wrong in the economy, even if mainstream commentary and mainstream understanding of what's going on doesn't match what people perceive. And I think it's a very simple thing to see in the economic statistics when you look at it from a wider perspective than just the last few quarters of GDP. Yes, Italy's economy is growing again, but that is not economic growth. It certainly isn't a recovery.
Okay, Jeff, and obviously it's not just Italy. This is a global problem. So where do we move to next?
Well, on slide 140, you see that this Italy is not an outlier. Italy is a more extreme case, but it's on the same spectrum as the entire European economy. Europe's economy, in nonlinear terms, which is what really matters, has shrunk too. Real GDP has been positive for, I believe it's 19 quarters consecutively. So it's still growing again, but it doesn't really matter. That's not a recovery. Italy's economy in 2008 suffered a break. It wasn't a recession. The Great Recession couldn't have been a recession because the economy afterward never recovered and therefore it never reattained the prior trend. And so Italy isn't alone in its problems. And you can understand why there's widespread anger about a number of topics, political topics in Europe, because by and large, the economy is described in the mainstream as having recovered when in fact we see that it hasn't.
Jeff, we've been talking about Europe. I see that on slide 141, you're painting the picture of the United States. It looks almost the same. So how can that be that between continents, we're seeing almost exactly the same story play out?
Yeah, and that's not supposed to be possible, Eric. And you think about orthodox economic theory, treats each of these economies as closed systems. And so if we find an economic recovery or lack of recovery in an economic pattern, it's almost exactly the same and almost exactly identical across continents. There's only a limited number of ways that could happen. And so what we're really talking about here, obviously, is that the euro-dollar system as a global currency has impacted the global economy in exactly the same way across all of these geographic boundaries, as you would expect once you appreciate the system for what it is, as a global phenomenon, not just a limited dollar issue or an offshore currency. It's the thing that pulls everything together in terms of marginal direction and in terms of what we see is, again, a paradigm shift in banking and dollar capacity and a parallel paradigm shift in economic capacity, exactly as you would expect when you realize the importance of money in any economy.
Well, with that explanation in place, it comes as no surprise that China comes into the story, and we're seeing again a similar picture, although maybe a sawtooth pattern this time. What's going on with China?
Yeah, slide 142, you know, just as people thought that maybe the emerging markets, especially China and Brazil and the BRICS, places like that, they would be able to escape the ramifications and implications of the early Eurodollar panic in 2008, it was believed after everything was over that that was going to be the case afterward too, even though the U.S. economy and the European economy never really had robust growth in the early recovery period. The emerging markets, especially Chinese, did seem like it was going to be a full recovery for them. However, we had additional Eurodollar problems in 2011 and 2014 that we can see from the Chinese economy in particular, but also some of the other emerging market economies too. They have been pulled into the same recovery pattern or lack of recovery pattern as both Europe and the United States. The idea is on a recession that you get this V-shaped, that for however deep the recession or the contraction portion is, there's an equal or better recovery on the other side so that the trend is never broken. What we keep finding in all of these places, which is the telltale sign of monetary euro-dollar issues, are these L-shaped recoveries. Whether it be Europe, whether it be Italy, the United States, and now China, Brazil, all the places all around the world, and they all align with these specific euro-dollar events. Again, the point being that, you know, on slide 143, that we can trace back political, social problems that are cropping up all over the world with economic problems that themselves trace back to this euro-dollar issue that, despite so much distance in time, has never been solved, has never been resolved to the point where actual recoveries can take place in all these places around the world.
Okay, Jeff, let's go back to the big picture now. In season one of Eurodollar University, we learned all about the pivotally important role that the Eurodollar system has served in providing dollar liquidity throughout the global financial system. And this was just critically important to the operation of the global system. It's what pulled everything together. And in many ways, we discovered in season one that the commercial banking system was stretching the rules a little bit, almost getting away with actions that are normally reserved for central banks by creating money supply effectively through their use of things like rehypothecation of assets, you know, using the same collateral twice and so forth. So as we're coming to the end of season two of Eurodollar University, we've seen consistently throughout season two that ever since August 9th of 2007, this system broke and it stayed broke. It has not been operating to provide the kind of U.S. dollar liquidity that the system provided before 2007. And one of the most important lessons, I think, of season one was the fact that most people, including regulators and central bankers, never fully understood or appreciated the role that the Eurodollar system had played previous to 2007. So this just opens a whole rat's nest of questions in my mind, Jeff, it sounds like what we're saying is something that nobody ever really understood that played a pivotally important role is now broken. But because people don't really understand the role that it was playing, the fact that it's broken, the Eurodollar system is broken, and that is contributing in a huge way to the continuing problems that we have in the economy. If I understand your contentions correctly, you're saying that regulators and central bankers and so forth probably still don't fully understand the role that the Eurodollar system used to play and how encumbered it has become since August 9th of 2007. First question, is that correct? Second question, dude, holy cow, what does that mean in terms of the future? It sounds like you're saying that the system's broke, it ain't going to be fixed as far as we can tell, and the regulators don't even understand that this is what the problem is. Am I exaggerating to put it in those terms?
I wish you were, Eric, because that would make it, I think, for a lot of people more palatable. And I understand that, you know, what we're talking about here is a big deal. I mean, this is not some small thing to basically say that central bankers have no idea what they're doing in terms of money. It sounds like a big intuitive leap that a lot of people aren't ready to make. But that was the issue here when we're talking about the shadows of offshore currency, the balance sheet capacity, credit default swap. These are all things that people just don't understand. And what happened, and by and large, to a big degree, was that when all of this stuff happened, people gave Ben Bernanke the benefit of the doubt. They said, okay, well, all this stuff is going on. We don't know what's going on. So you probably know better than anybody else. And that was a false assumption. And it was a false assumption that was based on the pre-crisis way that the Eurodollar system had evolved that made it seem like central bankers did know what they were doing. And I think that's another important piece of evidence of the paradigm shift we're talking about here is that before 2007, people like Alan Greenspan were held in such high esteem and high regard because it really did look like he knew what he was doing and that he could govern the economy through nothing more than quarter point adjustments in a federal funds target rate. Whereas afterwards, we get to after August 2007, Ben Bernanke, under his Federal Reserve leadership, can't do anything right. Doesn't matter what the guy does. And I'm including the QEs afterwards in that too. Doesn't matter what the Fed did, nothing actually happened the way it was supposed to happen. And the reason is because the Eurodollar system broke, and these people don't even know or don't really want to know much about what's going on there. And so the implications are, if it is broken, and I think there's almost no doubt that it is, just look at the way those bank balance sheets that we presented before, the system is broken in a permanent, durable fashion, and the central bankers don't know that it's broken or don't understand the implication that it's broken. What happens? What happens is exactly what happened over the last 10 years. Nothing changes. We go into these periods of crisis and recrisis, and then maybe a little bit of economic upside in between them. And overall, though, because the monetary system is a persistent drag on the economy, nothing ever recovers. There's no growth. There's no actual opportunity. And so people start to get restless and disenchanted with the status quo. And it opens up the door to all these other problems, not just economic problems, but social and political problems that proliferate not just in the places that we've been talking about, but places we don't even think that would be involved in it. Because again, this is a global currency system. This is a global paradigm that applies to everyone.
Hang on a second, Jeff. I want to summarize this and put it in context because this is just so profoundly important. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that Alan Greenspan was regarded as the maestro, the brilliant genius. You're saying actually that was an illusion. He didn't do anything particularly good, bad, or indifferent. He just happened to be in office at a time when the Eurodollar system was working. It was providing this tremendous amount of dollar liquidity globally. That was making everything look shiny and wonderful, rainbows and unicorns. Ben Bernanke comes on the job. It looks like he's struggling at every turn. You're saying it has nothing to do with Bernanke's policy choices. You're saying he just happened to be the guy who was entering office at a very unfortunate moment, right around the time, actually slightly before, the Eurodollar system irrevocably broke. It's been broken ever since. And it sounds like what you're saying, okay, how is, you know, Yellen's style different from Bernanke? And how is Powell going to be different from Yellen? You're saying it doesn't matter. They're screwed no matter what. The Eurodollar system is still broken. Doesn't matter what Jay Powell does next. Doesn't matter if he's got a different approach to things or a different way of thinking than Janet Yellen did or than Ben Bernanke did. It ain't going to work because the Eurodollar system is the real problem and they don't even understand that that's the problem. Am I exaggerating to summarize it that way?
No, not at all. I think that's exactly the case, that we're exactly what's happened. And it explains in a very high level really what's gone on, not just for the last 10 years, but the last 40 years. You know, Alan Greenspan was an accidental genius. It looked like, okay, what he was doing was causing this great moderation, as they called it in the early 2000s, when in fact, the reason they thought he was responsible for it was because nobody had any idea what it really was. In fact, the people who coined the term great moderation weren't really sure either. All they knew was that, okay, maybe it was Alan Greenspan, because we don't have any evidence that it wasn't. And even if you go through the Federal Reserve and policy discussions of the time, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, they weren't really sure either. They presented a united front that, yeah, we know what we're doing and we've got it down into a science. Their internal discussions, there was a lot more uncertainty there than they presented to the public. And the reason being was that they knew they couldn't define money. They admitted it many times, and especially Alan Greenspan more than anybody else. They could not define money, which was essentially our topic, and that was our point in Eurodollar University Season 1, was to show that throughout this tremendous and massive evolution, it got to the point where central bankers couldn't identify money at all. And if you can't, as a central banker, identify money, then how the hell can you do monetary policy in an effective way? And how would you even know if you're effective or not effective, whether it's a crisis or not?
Well, Jeff, the things that you're saying have just immensely profound implications because, first of all, the global financial system is a pretty big deal by itself. You're saying the people in charge of it don't really understand what aspect of it is broken or why it's broken, and they're trying to fix the wrong things. But I would say even more importantly, you know, we're clearly at the stage now where we're seeing the transmission from just economic problems into major social problems around the world. The economic conditions that have persisted, it's leading to all the youth unemployment in Europe, which is causing massive waves of crime. I think that we are headed towards a situation where wealth inequality is going to lead to massive civil unrest. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say significant human bloodshed, as there are conflicts between governments and people. People who feel that their interests have not been represented and that they're being screwed financially by the system. The only possible way that society can come out of this without a horrific, horrific human crisis is for the people in charge to do a good job of fixing the problems. And you're saying they don't even understand where the problems exist in the system. They have no idea of what's causing it. They're focused completely on the wrong things. And it doesn't matter what they do because, you know, you're trying to solve the problem of the toilet won't flush by changing a light bulb. It doesn't have anything to do with that.
I think a little bit deeper than that, because not only are they not solving the problem as it is, they don't have any answers for why the problem isn't solved. The fact that they had to do more than one quantitative easing tells you that they don't really know what the hell's going on, because if you have to do it twice, it wasn't really quantitative easing. And rather than reassess at that point, maybe we don't know here, maybe there's something else going on here, they continue to do the same thing over and over again. But not only did they do the same thing over and over again, if you ask them, they'll tell you it was effective. And so it's not just that the economy isn't recovering, that there's this wedge of mistrust growing between authorities and people, that a lot of people who aren't experiencing any of that economic growth that is happening in linear terms, which creates this perception of, okay, even today, people are saying the economy is booming, and a lot of people are saying, what the hell are they talking about? How can it be that the economy is booming? I don't see it. And so it's not just that the economy doesn't work or that the authorities can't figure out why. It's that they're saying that it's not even a problem. You're not even allowed to say that the economy is an issue anymore, or you're especially not allowed to say that there's a monetary issue behind all of it. So we can't even get toward, we can't even move in the right direction. Because mainstream or orthodox or however you want to characterize it, the debate about what's wrong doesn't even get to step one. And step one is really, we still have to go back and figure out 2007 and 2008. We have to come to terms with the Eurodollar system before we can get working toward a solution. And unfortunately, I mean, it's 2018 already, and we're still talking about 2007 and 2008 when we should have progressed long past that point. I hate to take a pessimistic view of things. I don't want to be completely pessimistic about all of these things, although that's the way the direction of everything seems to be going. There are sources of positivity. There are things to be optimistic about. Because even though the Federal Reserve may not be interested in the euro dollar, that doesn't mean that other places are not. I mean, you see research pieces that occasionally come out, especially over the last couple of years since the rising dollar of 2014, 2016, places like the Bank for International Settlements, even the IMF have started to take a greater interest in this topic of euro dollars and offshore currency and a global balance sheet capacity types of issues. So the hope is that, okay, maybe if Jerome Powell is no different than Janet Yellen, which is no different than Ben Bernanke, maybe along the way, one of these other organizations will finally get fire lit under them to the point where they say, okay, now we really have figured it out. Now we can actually do something before the clock ticks down to something catastrophic.
Now, just to keep this in context, Jeff, I want to make sure that we don't come across to our listeners as if we're saying, okay, look, you know, the people in charge don't know anything, but Jeff Snyder knows exactly how to fix this. You're not saying that. You're saying you know where the real problem is. If I understand you correctly, you don't know how to fix it either. Is that right?
You know, I have ideas like anybody else would have ideas, but no, I mean, what is the answer here? The answer is a stable currency system, but what would that entail? That's an immense project. How would we take what we have now, which is a dysfunctional balance sheet capacity, derivative, whatever, however you want to classify it, how would we take that and turn it into something that actually works? And how would we go from where we are now, which is point A, to point B, which is where the system actually does work, and it's a happy day for everybody in the world? What are the dangers going from A to B? I mean, I can imagine there are tremendous risks involved with any kind of systemic reset of that nature. And so what comes next that would be positive? How do we fix this? This is a huge task that would require a whole lot of capability and capacity that's far beyond my capability because I just don't have enough information. I've spent 20 some odd years studying all this stuff, and I still don't know. I don't even know what I don't know. There are still parts of the system that are undiscovered, so to speak. There's still things that surprise me in the way the system has evolved and the way it works still. And so it would take a monumental effort to actually figure out how we get out of this.
So to summarize, the world is in a real pickle. We have a financial system which is badly broken and has been broken for about 11 years now. You contend that the people who are in charge do not appreciate the accurate understanding that you've shared with us as to why it's broken. But you admit that even if you could persuade the people in charge to understand and to recognize the nature, the true nature that you've shared with us of why and how the system is broken, you don't claim any more than anyone else to know how to fix it. You just are able to suggest that if we started with an accurate understanding of the problem, we might have a chance, and we're not even there yet in terms of where people's understanding is in terms of regulators and elected officials and so forth. My job as host is supposed to be to put a positive spin on this in order to close things down, Jeff. Any advice for me on how to do that? I'm a little bit at a loss here.
Well, I think the positive spin is, as I said before, it's not an impossibility. There is an interest in the world at large for fixing the problem. If you think about what the Chinese are doing, for example, they're reacting to the problem as it is rather than what it's supposed to be. And so if they do some things that cause enough people to pay attention to what they're doing, it could raise awareness of this issue to the point where, okay, maybe we reach a critical mass of people wanting reform and wanting to look at the monetary system because that's where it all makes the most sense. The primary impediment to all of this is central bankers. And you can understand why they would be the primary impediment because they're the ones to blame for all this. Not because they made the crisis happen, but because they allowed it to happen through nothing more than ignorance. And so if I'm a central banker, I don't want people blaming me. And so I'm going to say, you know, there can't be a monetary issue because I did all this QE and that obviously was effective. And so that's really the only thing that needs to be overcome, at least in terms of a major next step, is once we get past central bankers saying, well, it can't be my fault, then all these possibilities do open up. And there is the non-trivial chance that we get something like Bretton Woods 2 together, where you get the smartest people around who actually do understand what's going on with these banks and why the global currency system doesn't work and can actually work together cooperatively to figure out how to fix it in a way that doesn't cause another big disruption. These things are possible. The question is, are they likely? Can we get past the central banker objection? That's not as big a task as it might sound.
And it sounds to me, Jeff, like the really, really important point to drive home here is, will they come around to understanding where the problem is? Because I do think that there's a very realistic possibility in the next 10 years of another Bretton Woods-style conference. I'm a huge fan of Neil Howe's work on demographics and cycles, major long-wave business cycles. And in this fourth turning that we're in, usually major institutions get ripped down and rebuilt in the end. The thing is, it only works if the people who get nominated to be the participants in this Bretton Woods type of monetary conference that decides the new system that the world's going to work on, unless they are graduates of Macro Voices Eurodollar University, they're probably not going to understand all this stuff. Because frankly, Jeff, I don't think anybody but you understands this on the level that you understand it. So do you think that in your work, have you encountered other people, economists and so forth, that have the depth of understanding and see the same problems that you see? Or are you the only one who's thinking about this stuff?
I'm not the only one who's thinking about it, especially, again, in the last couple of years, more people seem to be gravitating toward the topic because it makes sense. There's a lot that's intuitively understandable, and I don't think it's necessarily an impediment that this is a very difficult and complex topic. I think what the primary issue is the fact that nobody has investigated it. And so it's basically a new discovery, so to speak. That's probably putting it too extreme of a term. It's just the fact that because the monetary system had been languishing as a topic of, you know, nobody wanted to really investigate for so long, that it's taken a lot of time for that to generate a lot of interest in it. And I think once the level of interest rises to the point where, again, some kind of critical mass is reached, you'll have enough people who are investigating it, who do have high-level capabilities to understand what's going on, that it will lead to, hopefully, something like a Bretton Woods II or something, some kind of systemic monetary reset that is required before the global economy can actually recover again.
Well, Jeff, I will cross my fingers that somehow, some way, Macro Voices Eurodollar University influences somebody somewhere to know the right thing to say to someone that causes somebody to know how to save the world, because I think that's what we're talking about here. And I just cross my fingers that people figure this out. Folks, we appreciate your attention to what's been a very involved and intricate series. Be sure to stay tuned to our weekly Macro Voices podcasts, where Jeff is a frequent guest and we talk from time to time about current activities in the Eurodollar markets and what they're telling us about current market and investment conditions. Jeff, thank you so much for another fantastic season of Eurodollar University. Now, have we told the whole story? Is there season three that we need to worry about, or are we pretty much covered it?
There's a lot left to discover, and I think there's a lot left to talk about still. Quantitative easing, 2011, 2014, so there might be future seasons ahead.
We'll certainly stay in touch with Jeff and consider season three if it makes sense to do so. Before we close, I'd like to extend my personal thanks to Jeff's boss, Alhambra Investments founder and CEO, Joe Calhoun. Eurodollar University has been more popular with listeners than any other project in Macro Voices history to date. Unlike our usual format guest interviews, which typically consume about 45 minutes of the guest's time and draw on presentation materials that they usually already have on hand, Jeff Snyder has literally spent weeks of dedicated effort designing this content and preparing the extensive slide decks that you've received for Macro Voices University Seasons 1 and Season 2. All of Jeff's effort was dedicated exclusively to Macro Voices listeners, and several weeks of his salary at Alhambra were consumed in the process. Then, after we used up so much of Jeff's time producing Eurodollar University Seasons 1 and 2, when we announced our first Macro Voices live event in Toronto on August 10th of 2018, I got a call from Joe Calhoun saying he'd be happy to cover Jeff's travel expenses and salary to participate as one of our featured speakers at the event at no cost to us. We've offered several times to reciprocate by giving Alhambra some sort of advertising or promotional consideration on Macro Voices, but Joe has declined all of our offers, saying that he feels the show's advertising-free format is what makes it so popular with listeners, and he doesn't want to be the one to screw it up. Joe went on to say that his strategy has always been to use media opportunities simply to show off the brain power of his firm and let investors who are looking for an investment advisor put two and two together on their own and contact Alhambra when they're good and ready without being pressured by advertising. I just love this guy's style. Folks, it is incredibly rare to encounter someone with Joe Calhoun's character and personal integrity in the retail investment advisor business. So regardless of whether you're a retail investor looking for an advisor or just another professional in the industry who's enjoyed Eurodollar University, I really hope that you'll join me in expressing thanks to Alhambra founder and CEO Joe Calhoun, who made all of this possible without asking for anything in return. If you want to drop Joe a note, his email is jyc3@alhambrapartners.com. That's Juliet Yankee Charlie number 3 at alhambrapartners, all one word, .com. That concludes Part 7 and Season 2 of Macro Voices Eurodollar University. Be sure to check back, as there just might be a Season 3 still to come. And, of course, be sure to tune in each week for our free Macro Voices podcasts as well. You can subscribe on iTunes or at macrovoices.com. For Macro Voices, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.